Lowe's knows how to help you save. This July 4th, get up to 40% off select Maytag laundry appliances. Plus, get an additional 10% off when you buy two or three select major appliances. And when you buy four or more, you'll save an additional 20%. Find the right appliances and features that fit your home's unique needs and style. Shop Maytag 4th of July deals at Lowe's. Valid through 7/9. See Lowe's.com for details. Savings vary based on purchase amount. Selection varies by location.
Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. The world of fast fashion has complicated clothing production by shipping cheap parts around the world to whoever can sew them the cheapest. And now you, the consumer, are paying the price with rising costs. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. Skip the tariff and snag yourself American-made clothing with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
You are listening to the Hirschsprungs Hour on UK Health Radio, where I interview incredible people with a connection to Hirschsprungs disease and other associated conditions, such as IBD, IBS, Crohn's, colitis, and ulcerative colitis. Each week, I bring you a new and exciting interview with people from all walks of life, including charity founders, models, and professional sports people. We go through the ups and downs of having Hirschsprungs with a positive message throughout.
Hello and welcome to episode 71 of Tom's Hirschsprungs podcast. I am delighted to be joined all the way from Australia via Portsmouth, Lila McKenzie. Lila, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Tom. It's such a pleasure to be here. It's great to be, talking to you on the screen.
Fantastic. Yeah, no, I'm absolutely delighted to have you on. Was really, really glad when I got your message that said, I really want to come and tell my story. I have a one-year-old. Want to come and tell everything that we've been through when it comes to Hirschsprungs. So I'm really looking forward to listening to this story. So I guess probably the logical place is to start from the beginning, I guess. Would you like to take us from there?
Yeah, sure. Let's start at the start, hey. So I have two girls who are 5 and 3 now, and they don't have any kind of diagnosis. And then we now have a son who is currently 14 months old. So he was born in January 2024. And obviously, as people know about Hirschsprungs, that there's generally no clue that it's even there in the body prior to birth. So we actually had a home birth. So my first two children were born in the hospital, in the public system. And then third time around, we decided to have a home birth. So the birthing experience was incredible. I'm really, really grateful that I had that experience behind me, because I felt like I actually had quite a lot of reserves and energy and stamina to then go into the hospital system and try and navigate what was happening with our little Jordan. So, yeah, he was born quite swiftly and calmly and beautifully on my bed. And then it got to, I think, like most Hirschsprungs babies, it got to about 48 hours, probably a bit over that. And he started to lose interest in feeding, started to throw up some milk. But then it slowly started turning a bit more foamy. And then by the time we were on the way to the hospital, it was turning yellow and bilious. But prior to that, it was just over 48 hours. I had a midwife around, actually, who was visiting, and I was feeding at the time, and he vomited at the end of that feed, and she asked whether she should stay and wait till the end of the feed and help me some more and just be that support. And I said, no, it's okay. I'll just stay at home. Maybe I'll hop into the bed and continue to feed him and just see how we go. But within a few hours of that happening, I was on the phone to my second midwife. I had two midwives for the birth, and the other midwife, who was my primary caregiver, she then called ahead to the local emergency department and spoke to the pediatric team and just explained the symptoms and what was happening, and that I would be presenting to hospital. So I think I actually left it a little bit longer than probably what would have happened if I was obviously still in hospital. And because I was in a real newborn bubble bliss, you know, in my home, it was the first time ever that I'd had a baby at home and I wanted to stay at home and be tucked up in bed and not leave. And so I was trying my best to just hope that this would pass. And of course, obviously now we know that that was never going to be the case. So yeah, we got there as soon as we could once we realized that things were deteriorating quite rapidly. And I remember the drive to the hospital, it was about 45 minutes drive. And I sat in the back with baby Jordan and I just cried the whole way there because I knew deep down that something was seriously wrong, but I didn't know what. And of course, I was still hopeful that we might get to hospital and he would pass that first stool and then we would come home again. And I wasn't expecting to then be transferred to a bigger hospital, which my midwife did say to me on the phone, pack a bag and expect or anticipate that you might potentially be transferred to a larger hospital in the city. And when she said that, I just thought, oh, no, you know, we'll be home in no time. And you'll soon find out that is obviously not the case. So, yeah, the main symptom was or sign was that he didn't pass that first meconium poo. So we got to the local hospital, like I said, 45-minute drive. That's local over here.
Yeah, not here.
Yeah, no, everything's very far apart in Australia. So we're not completely regional, but somewhat. So yeah, 45-minute drive. We're in the emergency department. At this stage, there wasn't a separate pediatric emergency or a children's emergency and an adult one. Now there is at that hospital, but last year there wasn't. So we were in with everyone else. By this point, it was a Friday night. It was about 7 p.m. There was quite a few drug affected people kind of wandering around in the waiting room. There was actually a woman in front of me in the line who was being triaged at the desk and she had a cannula in her hand and she was obviously affected by drug use and she was asking for it to be ripped out and everyone was just, there was security there and it was quite a scary place to be with, you know, a two-day-old baby, even though I was an experienced mother of two previous children to have my third baby, but such a brand new baby and be in this kind of somewhat unsafe place is how it felt and not knowing what was going on. It was rather scary at the time. And then we got moved through quite quickly, obviously, because of the symptoms. And by this point, he was still deteriorating. So starting to go really kind of lethargic and continuing to vomit and, yeah, foamy and bilious. And we ended up in the emergency floor. I think we left there at about 1 or 2 in the morning. I remember, again, being in a cubicle, but you can hear, you know, it's on a ward. You can hear everyone around. And either side of us, actually, they were both adults that had a drug overdose. So there was, you could hear the talk of taking needles out of pockets and, you know, what have you OD'd on tonight and all that kind of stuff. And we're just there with this little tiny baby and Jordan was getting his cannula put in his hand and they still had no idea really what was going on. And there was no talk of Hirschsprungs at this point. And I was still very much advocating to try and get back home at this stage. So I was like, and I even said, can I just stay here at this hospital? Can I have a go on to a ward and just continue to try and feed and get him back home? And someone had to come and pretty much have quite a stern talking to me and say, this is really serious and you need to be seen by a specialist team. So that's when I realized, okay, we really do need to follow this through and I need to just listen to the medical staff and the professionals here and follow their lead. So I got transferred via ambulance with Jordan to the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne. So that was another hour and a bit probably in the ambulance. My partner drove back home, so 45 minutes in the opposite direction to then go and get the bag that we hadn't packed and then drive back to the hospital. So he pretty much arrived the same time that I arrived because he left before I got in the ambulance. I also remember Jordan was hooked up to an IV just with saline solution to keep him hydrated at that time. And the machine for the IV kept beeping and turning off and because they have to get the dosage really, really accurate on such a tiny baby. We were 10 minutes down the road in the ambulance and the machine kept beeping and turning off. So then we had to do a U-turn and come back to the original hospital to get that sorted because it was quite a long drive and they wanted to make sure that he was hydrated enough. And as we got back, actually, the same drug-affected woman that was that I met in the reception who wanted the cannula out of her hand was standing in the ambulance bay as we tried to park back in. So then we couldn't park and there was security trying to remove her. So we were delayed again by this same lady who I have absolute compassion for at the same time, because, you know, she's obviously going through a world of hurt and is struggling in her own life. But at the same time, you know, I've got this tiny baby and time is precious and I just needed to get back in there and then make our way. So that was quite frustrating and challenging to just sit there and wait. But anyway, we got that sorted. We got back to back on the road and on the way to Melbourne. And the Royal Children's Hospital is just incredible. We are under the absolute world-class team. But at the time, again, still not knowing what was wrong. This is early hours of the morning now on a Saturday. And yeah, those first couple of days in there were really tough, still trying to find out a diagnosis. They did a colour contrast test from the top down and the bottom up to see if there was any kind of obstruction or blockage, which there wasn't. So in a way, I felt like that was good, but at the same time, we had no answers. And they were potentially worried about a twisted bowel or something else, but that wasn't the case. And at this point, he was nil by mouth. We stopped breastfeeding. I was just expressing milk in a pump and putting it in the fridge and waiting. But we were just doing maximum skin to skin, just keeping him on us. My partner and I were just tag teaming. We were allowed to stay with him 24/7. So this is a, you know, intensive care department. There was a pod or a room with two babies in. And yeah, we were just allowed to stay bedside 24/7. We weren't allowed to sleep in there. Technically, we had a chair, which we would doze off in every now and then. And if the nurse caught us sleeping, she would say, you'd need to go and get a bed and leave. But we'd be like, no, we're awake. Then my partner and I are just tag team. So he had a room. They gave us a room as well downstairs with a bed. So we would just do 3 or 4 hour shifts and just rotate and just spend time holding Jordan and just staying with him and talking to him and cuddling him and just, you know, running through all the tests that they needed to do. And then there was talk of Hirschsprungs and there was a mention of the biopsy. And at that time, again, I was still advocating hard and really reluctant to intervene any more than was required. And I think this is coming from a place of a home birth where I was trying so hard to not be in a medical system. And, you know, medical systems are absolutely incredible. You know, it saved his life. But at the time, I was like, surely he doesn't need all this. You know, like, this is a bit overkill. So I said, initially, I declined the biopsy, which my partner wasn't happy with. So we were having our own internal kind of conversations about what we thought was right for Jordan, which is, you know, an ongoing struggle as a parent is wondering whether you're making the right choice for your child. And so that pushed things back 24 hours, which in hindsight, obviously, I would have made a different decision. But I still back what I did at the time because I was just doing what I thought was best and what I thought was right. I just said, just give us 24 hours more. I'd like to reintroduce breast milk and just see what happens. And if he vomits and, you know, the symptoms come back, then sure, let's go for the biopsy. So we did that and we reintroduced breast milk and the vomiting started again. And then I was like, right, okay, so it's obviously now that we do need to do the biopsy. But then they pushed us, they said, now you have to wait 24 hours because he's vomited again. We need to wait for that to clear, which I didn't know at the time that that was going to push things back a day, but it did. And time felt so crucial at this point. So then I was really, really upset, but I had declined it to start with and then it got moved to 24 hours. Anyway, the biopsy was done. That was something that they recommended that we left the room for. And I, again, advocated for Jordan and said that I would really like to be present and I want to just be up by his head, holding his hand, talking to him, explaining everything that's happening. I know he's only 2 days old, but, you know, he's going to hear my voice. Even if he doesn't understand the words, he's going to feel more calm and comfort if I'm there. And the surgeons explained that it could be quite traumatic for a parent to witness, you know, it's quite invasive. And I just said, that's okay. Like, you know, I'm not going to feel traumatized. If anything, I'll feel more traumatized by leaving the room and not being present and not knowing what's going on and knowing that he doesn't know where we are. So, yeah, I stayed present for the biopsy and Jared did leave the room and went and had a sleep. And that's my partner. And, yeah, it was actually really special to be present for that and just talk him through it. And I felt like he was a lot more calm than potentially what he might have been if I wasn't there. So that was done, and within, I think it was that same evening, actually, they came back with the results that it was Hirschsprung's. And at the time, we just thought, great, you know, we've got an answer. That's amazing. And we know that now the next step is to have surgery and have this pull-through procedure. And then after that, he'll be able to poo by himself. And then off we go on our merry way. So I was just really relieved that we knew what it was at that point in time. And I remember the surgeon saying to me, we're really sorry, this is not the diagnosis you want to hear, and this is going to be really tough on you. And I was just like, no way. Like, I'm so so grateful we know what it is. So then we were educated by the specialist team there. They have a colorectal team at the Royal Children's, and two specialist nurses, Jess and Susie, shout out to them because they are incredible. And they came bedside every day, and they educated us on how to do the washouts quite quickly. And I jumped in with Jared and we learned that process. But there was a couple of hiccups. I think by day five, and actually this might have even been before, I think this was before the results of the biopsy. Day five, he took a turn, and there was a fear that he was going down the path of sepsis. So, and he was really lifeless that day. He didn't open his eyes all day. He was really struggling. And I said to the doctors that morning on the rounds, I said, I'm really worried about him now, and I feel like he's deteriorating.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
You know that feeling when you're about to score 30% off, but they want your number? Ugh. Give them your Line 2 number instead. It's a second line on your phone, perfect for nabbing promo codes without inviting spam to your party. Sign up for every discount under the sun, then block the junk texts that follow. You get all the perks, but none of the spammy baggage. More codes, less chaos. Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store and get your shopping sidekick today. Because the only thing blowing up your phone should be good deals.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And I didn't know that sepsis was on the cards, but I saw it later on the medical notes, that was a potential flag. And I remember actually also on that day, and I've got goosebumps now just thinking about what happened, but I held him in my arms and I looked at him and I just talked to this, you know, 2-day-old baby, or actually 5-day-old at that point, and so floppy, so lifeless, didn't even open his eyes. And I just had this conversation with him and I just said, if you need to go, like if you need to die, then that's okay by me. I didn't say it like that. I just said, this is your journey. This is your life. I'm just here as your mother to support you and guide you and walk beside you. And this is your journey and your life, and I'm not here to control it. So if it means that you need to go and you need to leave us, then, you know, I'm here with you and I'm going to support you every step of the way. So I had this really profound conversation with a 5-day-old baby and explained that it was just the ultimate surrender and letting go and showing him and putting all of my trust in him as a baby and just knowing that whatever is meant to be will be, and I've just got to sit with that. So that was the real pivotal moment for me in kind of almost accepting that if he died, then that's part of life. Like, you know, if you can enjoy life this much, you've got to be accepting of grief and death, because, you know, we've all got the same outcome in the end. We're all going to die. No, I know no one really talks about it and it's quite a taboo subject, but I was really open with Jordan from the start. And I'm so glad that I had that conversation. And our connection was really, really deep from the start, from the birth process and before that, even in pregnancy. So, yeah, I just felt really connected and attuned to him. And I had that conversation and I felt like that shifted everything, mainly in my own head, to accept what was going to be will be. So, Yeah, of course, that is not the case. He is an absolutely thriving, healthy one-year-old now. But that was like the lowest of the low, as you can imagine, in the hospital that day. And I think it was either that evening or I think it was that evening then we got the results and then we heard about Hirschsprung's and then we had a plan, you know, and then we started. I think the washouts hadn't really started then. So that's, I think, why he was declining so much, was because he hadn't had that relief and that flush through his system. And maybe they had, but they weren't being done regularly enough. So as soon as we knew it was Hirschsprung's, they were doing the twice daily washouts. They were on top of it. We were allowed to slowly reintroduce milk. We did take that really slow. There was times when we gave him too much milk and then he would vomit and we'd have to take a back step and pull back on the amount we were giving him. And because I wanted to breastfeed him directly, that was tricky for the hospital because they wanted to measure, you know, exact input of milk. But I knew that in terms of, again, attachment and connection to the mother-baby dyad is really important that they have direct breast milk if they can. And I know not everyone can breastfeed, and I'm really grateful that I was able to have that journey with him. But yeah, so there was a bit of, there was just ongoing conversations with the nurses and making sure that he was getting what he needed, but not too much in terms of nourishment. Yeah, so we slowly got through, you know, after that each day got better and better. And I think we were in there 12 days all up, and then we were allowed to go home. So, you know, we went home with our washout gear and then we knew that we were going to come back. At the children's, they do around 3 months of age, they do the pull-through procedure. I know it's different depending on where you're cared for, but 3 months was the age for us. So, yeah, he was born in the January, and then in the April, he went back in for his pull-through procedure. So between getting home in late Jan and April, we were just doing the twice-daily washouts. We were breastfeeding, and I was breastfeeding as normal, and that was our life. Yeah, up until April. So our two older children, that was their new normal, was to be a part of those washouts and help us get all the equipment. And yeah, they did amazing because that's a lot for them to handle as well. And then it got to April and yeah, he had his pull through surgery. It was short segment, which is obviously what everyone is hoping for as a diagnosis when you have Hirschsprung's. So we were really, really grateful that we got the phone call from the surgeon. I think it was maybe an hour or so into surgery that they've called and said it's short segment and, you know, he's going through to recovery soon and you'll be back with him in about 20 minutes or so. It might have been longer. It might have been 2 to 4 hours. I can't remember now. But yeah, it was such a wild ride, all of that. And then even just to meet him in recovery and not expecting to see him so puffy. And yeah, it was quite... quite a shock to see him in that way, quite confronting. But then the recovery process was reasonably good for him. I think we were, can't remember how long we were in there, 5 days, maybe. Maybe a week. I think it was a week. And then, yeah, he started stalling by himself. That was amazing. I remember, I think it was myself. I wasn't on shift with Jordan at that point. So Jared was with him. And I was having a sleep. We were still doing our rotation tag team stuff. And then Jared texted me and just said he's done a poo by himself and did the poo emoji. And I just like sprung out of bed like, oh, my God. And then he texted me again before I even got dressed and said, make that 2. And then he texted me again. He's like, make that 3. And it was a big one. And I was just like trying to race to the hospital and get back into his room and see this for myself. And I think many of your listeners will know that once it starts and, you know, it really, really comes. So. Yeah, then it was just amazing to see him stalling by himself. So then we went home after about a week and he was great for about 6 weeks. And then he got his first proper virus. So we had 6 weeks of no washouts, just kind of our new normal life with him pooing by himself. And then after 6 weeks, he got his first virus. And I think because having two older siblings who are in care and visiting friends and stuff, there's a lots of germs and bugs going around our house. So, yeah, he got a virus and then he got enterocolitis off the back of that. So that was our first experience of that life-threatening infection. So, and I think at the time I was quite slow to pick up on the symptoms, because I didn't know exactly what I was looking for. And some of the symptoms to start with are quite subtle. So, yeah, I rushed to hospital with him And I remember being in the emergency there, and they're amazing. Like, I spoke to Susie on the phone directly, and she said, yeah, come in, bring him in. You sound quite concerned. I'm going to let the emergency department know you're coming. So they had all of his history. As soon as you get there into the emergency, they bring up his notes, and you kind of got, I got whisked through quite quickly. And again, because he was deteriorating quite rapidly, I remember standing there in a room and not being able to sit down and just holding him, and he was just getting worse and lifeless. And his vomit ended up having brown specks of what I believe was feces in it. I didn't know at the time whether it was blood or what it was, but I think now from doing a bit of research, I think that was fecal matter in his vomit. So we got rushed through quite quickly that time. It was a five-night stay, antibiotics, washouts. He recovered from that, and then we came home, and within 4 to 6 weeks, maybe even 2 weeks, I think, 2 weeks after that, he got it again. So then we went back again, had a two-night stay, antibiotics again, IV washouts, came back home, and then it happened again twice more. So in the space of about 4 months, no, 6 months, he had enterocolitis at least four times. Only two that we were admitted for into hospital, and the other two we managed at home. So by this point, I was getting quicker at noticing those subtle symptoms to start with. And then I was like, right, we just got to get on these washouts quicker. And then, yeah, for two of those episodes, we just gave him antibiotics orally at home with a syringe while I was breastfeeding. I'd just poke it in the side and give him those. That medicine that way. So yeah, we managed to avoid hospital for those second two episodes of enterocolitis. So that was a really rough patch. And then they suggested, once he got a bit better, they suggested that we go down the Botox trial path. So, oh, and we were doing dilatations as well during this period. So we'd done a lot of months worth of daily dilatations. I think that was after this. Yeah, it must've been after the surgery. So there was at least a daily intervention for him, which is just so full on. And then, yeah, we got to the Botox trial and they suggested, let's give him Botox, general anesthetic, quick in and out in half a day. And that has been very effective. You know, it's had mixed results, but it has seemed effective enough to offer it to many families. So we were happy to give that a try. After the rough trot that we'd had for, you know, he was 10 months at this point, 10 months old, he had the Botox. And that was really effective for 6 days. And then he got a new virus and then he just stopped stalling. So he didn't have enterocolitis to the point that we needed to give him antibiotics, but there was definitely some early symptoms. So we just started washouts again after 6 days. And then we continued washouts up until really recently. So I think he turned one. I actually came back to the UK with him late December through the new year, just for a 10-day stay. While he was there, he had some symptoms and we ended up in the urgent care centre down in Portsmouth and got him on some oral antibiotics. And I was doing washouts at home with my mum at this point. So I trained her up to do those. And I was doing dry catheters on the plane. So I'm on this Emirates plane in the toilet with my catheter trying to relieve the pressure for him on the flight, which is not ideal. I'm sure I'm not the only one that's done that. I'm sure, you know, there's all sorts that goes on in those airplane toilets. But yeah, that was an experience in itself. Anyway, I got back to Australia from the UK in the day before his birthday. So on the 9th of January, he turned one on the 10th of Jan. And then I think we did three washouts in that week of his birthday. And since then, we haven't done one. So we're now in, March? And he's just suddenly, I don't know what happened, but he turned one and he's just decided that everything's so much easier in terms of function of his body. So, yeah, he's stalling spontaneously. We're not doing any interventions. There's no sign of needing any further Botox or surgery. He's just doing really, really well. We give him a daily Osmolax in his water, and that seems to help. And other than that, the one thing that I have focused on is my diet, which I know Simone Rist, I listened to her episode recently that you've had on your podcast. And I remember she talked quite a bit about diet with her son, Oscar. And that's something that we've definitely focused on too. It's been more so me because I've been the one breastfeeding. And so I've really changed my diet, but we're noticing it now with Jordan and introducing food. It took him 5 months to even really consume anything. So We started introducing solids at 5 months old, and it took him till 10 months to eat anything. So he was solely reliant on breast milk till then, which was a real strain on me. And it was a real concern that he wasn't potentially ever going to eat. But again, he just suddenly turned a corner with that and now just absolutely loves food. But we're just quite mindful of what we give him. So it's just going to be an ongoing journey and lesson. And who knows if he's going to need further surgeries or whether he's going to have enterocolitis multiple more times. I do feel like we're through the worst of it. Touch wood, you know, he's 14 months now. I think that first year is the hardest. And I know that they often say that, you know, the first 2 to 3 are quite tricky. And I'm sure there'll be ongoing challenges, especially when we get to toilet training age and beyond. But at this stage, prognosis and his current, you know, daily life is rather normal. And he's just a really happy, thriving boy at this stage. So, yeah, that's where we're at now.
That's brilliant. That's so good to hear that he's doing really well now. Because I do speak to a lot of people and they are going through very similar stages to what you've been through, and to know that, you know, it's that light at the end of the tunnel, isn't it? It's to know that, you know, we're never going to sit here and say, you know, in 5 months, 8 months, 10 months, everything's going to be fine. We can't say that, but to know that there are people who go through lots of different challenges, and boy, you've been through challenges, that there is light at the end of the tunnel is so reassuring, and that's really, really great to hear. I also did a few things you mentioned within there. The first poo, obviously lots of Hirschsprung's mums will know exactly what you mean by that, but I think a lot of people who haven't experienced Hirschsprung's will kind of have no idea really just how important that is to you and to your husband as well. Can you kind of, I know you mentioned a little bit about getting the text from your husband and saying he's been, it's great and everything. Just can you explain sort of how that felt getting that message? Because I really think that's a feeling that only a Hirschsprung's parent would understand.
Yeah, you're so right. And it was just this absolute elation. I think we, as a society, we just totally take for granted, you know, our bodily functions, especially down that end. You know, it's not something you generally talk about, especially as an adult. You know, poo jokes and fart jokes are funny when you're 5 or 6 and somewhat when you're a bit older. But yeah, I remember talking to a surgeon actually, and I'm slightly going off topic from your question, but I remember talking to a surgeon in the intensive care in the NICU, and she was from Switzerland and she was incredible. And we had some beautiful bedside conversations. And she was there doing a washout one night and she was saying, I don't dare tell my parents. I tell them I'm a surgeon, but I don't talk to them about what kind of surgeon, because everyone really honors and celebrates brain surgeons and heart surgeons, but anything to do with bowel, it's like, oh, you know. But it's, if you can't poo, you die. Like, it's such a necessity, you know, even more so potentially than parts of your brain. And so to have that first poo was just unbelievable. I remember we were taking photos, and I still celebrate now, you know, like, he's 14 months, he's stalling really well, but every time he does a poo, I'm just so grateful. Like, I'll look through it, I'll just be happy that he's going by himself. I remember we were taking photos on that first day when he started stalling by himself. I kind of joked with my partner and with the surgeons and the rest of the team that I was going to have it framed and maybe even just somehow get that nappy, like, gold plated or made into some kind of trophy, or just put it on the wall somehow, like, not obviously the actual poo, but some kind of example of it on the wall, which we haven't done. But that was the feeling that I had, was this really means, this is a big, big milestone for him and for us as a family. Yeah, it was incredible.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Ugh, spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
You know that feeling when you're about to score 30% off, but they want your number? Ugh. Give them your Line 2 number instead. It's a second line on your phone, perfect for nabbing promo codes without inviting spam to your party. Sign up for every discount under the sun, then block the junk texts that follow. You get all the perks, but none of the spammy baggage. More codes, less chaos. Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store and get your shopping sidekick today. Because the only thing blowing up your phone should be good deals.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Absolutely. So long as you don't have it as saved as your screensaver, I guess. But no, that is really interesting to hear. So like I said, you know, I think it is only something that the Hirschsprung's parents really understand. And that sort of that anxious wait for sort of, you know, waiting for them to go is just so important. And then you mentioned another couple of things as well, Botox. That Jordan had at 10 months. I do see a lot of people on various forums talk a lot about Botox. Should we go for it? Shouldn't we go for it? What's the benefits? What might happen, etc. What was your feeling to go sort of with Botox at that time?
Initially, I wasn't for it. You can probably get an idea now that I'm kind of, I feel like the word is crunchy. I feel like there's a lot of talk of this crunchy parent, which is like doing anything that isn't Western medicine in terms of like natural remedies or like woo-woo. Or so I was very much like, maybe I can get some body work or do it all through my diet, or there's ways that I can do this without the intervention and need for Western medicine. So initially it was a no from me, but I think it was just the way that our life was, the way that his life was, the fact that we were doing these twice daily washouts, the fact that the surgery went so well to start with, but we actually only got 6 weeks worth of good function. And that he was, you know, we were off the back of 4 episodes of enterocolitis. And I just thought, this is just relentless. And it was so, you're just living on the edge at all times. You can't relax. You're constantly looking for symptoms, and any little, you know, cry, or if he goes floppy in any way, like even if he's playing, or, you know, you can't relax, and your nervous system is just so highly strung. And our quality of lives as a family, we were really struggling, I think. So we just thought it's actually worth a try. We spoke to the hospital. We read through the forums. Yeah, we had lots of backwards and forwards conversation. And at that point in time, we just said, okay, let's give it a go. And hopefully you only need one round, which at this stage we have, which is fantastic. And I know that there are many families that it has completely changed their life, and they go back regularly for top-ups, and, you know, they're so reliant on it now at this stage in their lives. The surgeon did say to us that there's many people in a similar boat where they're going through regular Botox top-ups in this kind of age bracket. So between that, like coming out of babyhood, going into toddlerhood, and by the time they hit 2 or 3, generally they kind of just grow out of it. And that's what the surgeon said to me. So in my head, after that first Botox trial, I thought, okay, this is our new path. I am more than willing to come back every 3 months or so if that's required to get these top-ups, and that will be our journey up until he's 3. And then hopefully by that point he will grow out of it, and his system will be able to manage by itself. And obviously we've had a much better outcome at this stage. So that was our journey, and that was our decision making when it came to Botox.
Absolutely. No, that's so good to hear as well. And when people talk about journeys back and forth, I don't think, especially with me living in England, don't quite realize just how far the journeys are for you in Australia, that everything is, Australia being that much bigger, a heck of a lot bigger, the journeys are, you know, a lot further. And I guess from that sense, planning has to be sort of really on point, to the point where you can't just forget something at home because it's 45 minutes away.
Yeah, well, we are actually, for us, it's about an hour and a half, between an hour and a half to 2 hours to the Melbourne Hospital, to the Royal Children's, which over here, that's like round the corner. Where my partner and I actually met and lived together for 4 years is right up in the north of the country. And the closest, there was a local hospital there, and we didn't give birth up there. So we moved, and we are way more, we've got a lot more access down here where we live. But if we were still up there, we spoke about this, my partner and I, and if we were still up there and we had Jordan and we were living with Hirschsprungs, it would be a completely different story. We would have had to fly via air, and it was a 4-hour flight to get from where we lived and where we met down to Perth. And even then, I think the care is somewhat less, it's still incredible, but it's somewhat less specialized. They don't have the same team as they do in Melbourne. So we're actually really lucky in terms of our location and access to the children's.
Yeah, definitely. And speaking of that specialist support as well, I know that your particular hospital that you've been sort of going back and forth to, they're looking at changing the way that they're going to staff that, I guess, would be the term. What do you sort of understand is happening there at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely right there, Tom. They're definitely restructuring the staffing of the team. So the specialist team that we're under is called the CPRS team, and it stands for colorectal. Oh, I'm going to get this wrong now. CP, colorectal and pelvic reconstruction service. I'm pretty sure
that's about right.
Colorectal and pelvic reconstruction service. And within that team, that was created and formed due to a $5 million funding program. And that was $1 million per year. And that funding actually ended at the end of 2024. So we got 12 months worth, the last 12 months of that funding, and that program we were able to access, which we didn't know at the time. So we had no idea that the funding was about to end, and therefore the team was going to be restructured. So from what I know, which isn't much, to be honest, the team has been not stood down, but the specialist nurses that we had access to are no longer working under that team. So the team itself, the CPRS team at this stage, are no longer there. They are still working at the hospital, but under the broader umbrella of pediatrics. So it's a specialized children's hospital, but there's no longer a CPRS team. So that means anyone with Hirschsprungs or any other complex bowel or pelvic condition go under the general pediatric care rather than the specialized team. So the surgeons, there's two main surgeons, Sebastian King and Liz McLeod, and they are still there and operating as normal. So you either end up with, one or the other. We were under Liz's team. So we still have Liz as a surgeon, but at this stage we don't need surgery. So we're not really in contact with her as such. But the specialised nurses, Jess and Susie, that I mentioned earlier, they were just an absolute lifeline for us. And it meant that at any time, if we had any question, anything pop up, anything unsure that we needed covering, we could just call them. It was business hours, but we could just call them. They would always pick up the phone and we could just chat to them. And we could send an email out of hours and they would always get back to us as soon as they could. So that was just so pivotal for us. And we just felt so well cared for, particularly with those two nurses. There was also, it's an allied health team. So there was also a psychologist on the team, making sure that all the parents and families were well cared for in terms of their mental well-being. That psychologist is no longer under that team. There was also a dietitian, which we did utilize. And when Jordan was struggling with starting solids, we went and saw the dietitian twice. And she, again, was a specialist for this team. And she is no longer working in that department. So at this stage, it basically doesn't exist other than the surgeons. So we are so grateful that we were able to access all of these people if we needed to. And we very much leaned on Jess and Susie in that first 12 months. But now if there was a baby, you know, if Jordan was born now, he wouldn't have access to all of those people. He'd still be able to have the surgery with the specialist surgeons. But yeah, we wouldn't have the rest of the team around us. So I have noticed each time that I have gone back for a checkup with the surgeon, we often get a registrar, and more recently it's been a different registrar each time, and then they end up knowing less and less about the history of each child, and there's just not that continuity of care, which is so important for anyone in the medical system, and very much in birth, as I learned, that if you've got that continuity of care, you just feel so much safer with your provider. And it just has better outcomes if you've got this continuity of care, which we felt like we absolutely had last year. This year it feels a bit different, but at the stage we're at, it's not having a huge impact on us as a family because Jordan is thriving at this stage. But yeah, if there was a baby born, well, there are being multiple babies born that are being diagnosed with Hirschsprung's, but they might be having a slightly different journey in that hospital because of the funding no longer being there. So there is a petition. It's only for anyone, residents within Victoria, which is the state that Melbourne is in Australia. So it's only if you're a Victorian resident that you can sign it, but it's an online petition. It takes 30 seconds to sign. It needs 10,000 signatures, and then it will go to Parliament, and then they will revisit and reassess whether that particular team will be have access to funding again and be reinstated. So I think last time I looked, that the petition was on about 6,500 signatures. So hopefully we get up to 10,000. I think it's got till August this year to gain at least 10,000. And then hopefully from there, potentially they will reinstate some funding and get that team back up and running, because it is absolutely so needed. And I think that there are, from what I've heard, there are more and more Hirschsprung's babies presenting in NICU and being diagnosed. So I don't know why, but that's what I've heard from each time I've been there. So it just seems to be raining Hirschsprung's babies. So if anything, that the team 100% needs to be reinstated and, yeah, put back in the hospital.
Absolutely. And obviously, if there's anything that, you know, that we can do as a podcast, we definitely will. We'll link the petition in the description below. And if anybody listening to this is from Victoria, then please. I mean, it sounds from what you've said, it sounds absolutely vital that this team stays. Because I know you've mentioned a couple of occupations there: psychologist, dietitian. You know, a few things that maybe when I had Hirschsprung's, you know, those types of people were not around. It was all done kind of physically, and okay, you've had the pull through surgery, we'll just make sure that you're okay physically. But to look at people as a whole now and say, right, actually, okay, how is your social well-being? How is your emotional well-being? How is your mental well-being? Not just, okay, have we done the surgery? Is everything fixed? I can't speak strongly enough on that. I think that's so important and not just, as you said, not just for the person going through the surgery, for parents and carers as well, because they, as you've mentioned, and I've spoken to, you know, many parents, you go through it as well. You really go through it, and to have that support, I mean, you know, is vital, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. I think you've just said that so beautifully, Tom, and thank you for saying it the way that you did, with the mental, social, the well-being is so important. Like, that is the core. And I think that we are now, there's a lot more awareness around the kind of the link between our mind and our body, right? And you know, like you said, in your experience when you were younger and going through the procedures, it was very much just a physical thing, and let's fix the problem and then let's move on. Okay, everything's functioning in terms of bodily function, so great, you're all good to go, off you go back home. But I think that mental and emotional support is so important, and if you've got that as your foundation, as well as obviously alongside the physical stuff and the actual surgeries and procedures that are required, I think they just need to come hand in hand. And obviously prior to, I don't know how long, but prior to that, especially in your case, it seemed like you didn't have access to that. So it's very, very important. And I think, yeah, it needs to be revisited, and mental well-being needs to be put at the forefront for everyone, including, like you said, the families, the parents, the siblings, everyone that's impacted by this condition.
Absolutely. And as we just sort of round towards the end, we've got a couple of minutes left here. In terms, I know you've spoken a little bit about Jordan and how well he's getting on now, which is so, so good to hear at 14 months of age. In terms of sort of the near future, what do you see for Jordan?
Well, I feel like we're only just coming into more of a normality. I think we were very much in survival mode, especially last year, you know, with what I've shared and the in and out of hospital and the surprise curveballs of enterocolitis. So I think we're just coming out of the back end of that, and obviously just hopeful that we are no longer needing to go back there for any surprise admissions or infections. So just continuing to live as normally as we can and continuing to see the specialist when we need to. Hopefully weaning off the Osmolax at some point. I think I've got an appointment actually this week with the surgeon, or one of the surgeon's registrars. We'll see who is there on the day. But I think the next step is potentially going to try and reduce that Osmolax and see how he goes. Hopefully that's not a forever thing. I think in my mind, I would like him to not need that. I know it's not a big deal, but I would absolutely love for him to get off of that. But you know, just taking each day as it comes. And yeah, I guess the next step is, as he grows more, is working towards what his bowel function is going to look like, and toilet learning, and then beyond that, schooling and seeing, you know, he's only one at this stage, but it'll come around quick, and then he'll be kinder and school age, or what would you call it there? Nursery, perhaps?
Yeah.
So when he hits that 3 or 4 year old mark, and those social interactions, and seeing how well he goes with that, and what his bowel function will be like at that point. Because we still actually have no idea whether he's going to have a normal functioning bowel that he can fully control, or whether he's going to be constipated, or whether he's going to, have consistent accidents. So we just don't know what that looks like yet. And we just got to, again, just surrender to the journey and just trust him and trust the process and just follow alongside him and guide him as best we can.
Definitely. I know it goes without saying, but I'll say anyway that I wish to see you and Jordan and the rest of your family all the very, very best for the future. And thank you so much for coming on and joining me today.
Thanks so much, Tom. It's been an absolute pleasure to share my story. And, you know, if one person listens to this and is somewhat inspired or relates to it, then, you know, that's exactly why we are here. So I just want to say thank you to you for creating the podcast and having this resource out there, because it's just such an amazing place to have all this information and for it to be free and for you to give up your time to do this. So thanks, Tom.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Hirschsprungs Hour on UK Health Radio. You can find me on Facebook under Tom's Hirschsprungs Podcast, or Instagram on Tom's_Hirschsprungs_podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show and we'll bring you another episode soon.
Ugh, spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.